Welcome to today's episode of the All Things PA Education Podcast. I'm Sarah Fletcher, CEO of the PA Education Association and your host for this show. It is my honor to welcome today an expert in simulation, Dr. Laura Gonzalez. Dr. Gonzalez is the VP of Innovation at Sentinel U. She is the immediate past president of Enaxel and a recognized simulation expert. She holds the prestigious Advanced Certified Healthcare Simulation Educator certification. In the fall of 2020, she was recognized by the prestigious American Academy of Nurses as a fellow. She is also a fellow of the Academy of Nurse Educators. Her nursing career focuses on advancing the science of nursing education through the use of simulation and its impact on learner outcomes. Dr. Gonzalez has a very specific body of work that has resulted in over 20 database manuscripts and peer-reviewed journals and one clinical skills textbook. She is one of several scientists to have two patents. She is a seasoned educator with experience teaching across the curriculum, including live, hybrid, online, and synchronous delivery methods. Her recent work has been exploring AI to identify best practices and the use of chatbots to increase learner engagement. Dr. Gonzalez, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you. I'm super excited for you to be here today. So talking about simulation and obviously your years of work and experience in this field, I'm just going to dive right in and ask you off the bat. Sometimes there's some skeptics out there, people who might think simulation just doesn't really come close to mimicking those live patient encounters. What do you say to those folks?
I think we'll always have those naysayers. I think that's just something that we have to continuously educate people on. But when you think about 25 years ago, the Institute of Medicine came out with the To Err Is Human safety report. It is really unacceptable that learners go into the clinical setting without having any previous exposure to the type of patients, to the type of experiences they can have. It's no longer see one, do one, teach one. There really is an onus on educators to make sure that the learners are adequately prepared. And one of the ways we do that is by using simulation. The ability to create a safe environment that learners can make mistakes in, they can repeat, redo, restart. I don't think there's a substitute for that. Is it the exact clinical experience? No, it's never going to be exact. Those are human beings, right? But it sure is important to help them provide that context, get them used to those situations, improve their confidence. I think the naysayers just need to really just invest some time and really try to understand what it is we're doing.
Absolutely. And not to mention, and you certainly have been a major contributor, all the research out there that really speaks to the effectiveness and the impact of simulation.
Can I just follow up? There is, since about, I don't know, maybe 2002, when we really started seeing the use of simulation, fast forward, there is a treasure trove of research and data that is out there that suggests that simulation is comparable to clinical experiences. And certainly you won't have any negative gains. They're all positively correlated to learner outcomes.
That's so important. Speaking of that, then tell us, what are some of the most effective uses of simulation in clinical training, or how can it be used most effectively to prepare those learners for the clinical practice?
I think depending on your learners, early exposure to simulation is ideal. And what you want to do, like everything in education, we scaffold learning. So they get introduced to what exactly is this methodology, this modality of teaching and learning. And you could use it for just skills, like psychomotor skills. Then you can create these scenarios that I feel like every single learner in the world who's entering healthcare needs to experience. And then you can make them more complex. You can start with some very basic learning outcomes and you scaffold them to be very high complex cases, not to mention the opportunities for interprofessional training, and not to mention the opportunities to really shore up those soft skills or those integral skills that we really need, those communication skills. Just, I can speak for nursing, and I'm sure it's very similar in the physician assistant world, the PA world. Just calling the provider or just calling, giving bad news, all of those things can be difficult when you're new in that space.
Absolutely. The ability to practice, like you said, without it being in the live session, especially with those communication skills as an example, I think that is super important for the confidence building. Not to mention, I wouldn't want to myself, even not being a clinician, have the first time I have to talk to someone, particularly about bad news or something, be the first time I'm doing it ever. Speaking of, you alluded to it already, but when do you advise the simulation actually be introduced in the curriculum then? I heard you say early as in didactic year.
I say early as in didactic year. Think about the ability to have a didactic, a live in-person class, and just bringing in a simulator. It doesn't have to be about a simulation, but it can be about demonstrating lung sounds, heart sounds, anything that's going to enhance the learning in the classroom, and then eventually flow into the simulation lab if you have a simulation lab. But remember, when you think about the learning trajectory of most healthcare learners, we have that didactic component, we have that clinical component. We really need to close the gap, and we use simulation in the middle. Really, so for instance, if I was teaching something, let's see, I was doing physical assessment in my didactic, I'm taking those learners to the sim lab, and we're going to go through an assessment, a cardiac assessment, a respiratory assessment, using that mannequin or that task trainer. My recommendation would be, if you have all the resources in the world, because we have to remember that not everybody's has as many resources, but I would suggest early and often.
Okay, great. And speaking of the resource disparity, and certainly that's a reality for PA programs, and I'm sure many other health professions as well. But let's say I am just brand new, starting out, learning a simulation. I want to try it. Where do you recommend I start?
Because I am the immediate past president of Anaxil, I would have to say the first thing you will need to do is download the Healthcare Simulation Standards of Best Practice. That really is our go-to manual to really understand what this is about. Anyone new to simulation, it's unfortunate, many people get thrown into simulation as their assignment. Right. And some of them come kicking and screaming and say, I don't understand this pedagogy. I don't like it. I don't believe in it. That doesn't make for a good learner experience. First of all, I think if this is your first assignment, embrace it and really say, okay, I want to understand what this means. But think about this, Sarah, and we've talked about this. You can be a top-notch clinician and you could be a mediocre educator, but now you're layering on another layer of competency and now you're a simulation educator. That's a lot to really overcome. And at the end of the day, it's all about the learner outcomes. I'm very biased when I talk about simulation education, and I believe you should be trained appropriately. You should have the correct skill set. You should be mentored. I don't think anybody gains anything from the educator being thrown into a simulation experience, expected to guide these learners through this SBE, simulation-based experience, when you yourself are just struggling to understand the pedagogy. I believe in continuous professional development, going to conferences, really learning, listening to things like this. There's so many resources nowadays. There's Anaxil, the Society for Simulation in Healthcare, not to mention our ASPE partners. Do yourself a favor as a new simulationist. If this is something you enjoy, you really want to be the best you can be.
That's great advice. And I appreciate you sharing those resources, because I know for all the great outcomes that simulation can provide and great experiences, there's also some cautions and some mistakes that can be made. Can you speak about those?
Absolutely. One of the caveats, probably about 10 years ago now, there was a huge study that looked at nursing and simulation and found that, as I mentioned, the clinical outcomes were comparable. But the caveat was it had to be done by someone who was versed in simulation, who created quality simulations, who followed the simulation standards of design. That's how you guarantee an equitable experience. It's no longer, let's just think of something and put it together. There's a lot of thought that goes into creating a high quality simulation. It takes time and it has to be vetted, and you have to have your subject matter experts. You have to make sure your references are evidence-based. That takes time. So I wouldn't want anybody to think, oh, this is easy, right? Because it can have adverse effects. We talk about the traumatic impact. And I remember 20 years ago, we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't think it through, if you know what I mean. We let the simulators die. At first blush, it sounds fun. Let's see what happens. But it is traumatic to an early learner to have a simulated patient die. Talk about the debrief and the psychological safety and these learners feeling like, I have failed. I'm going to fail as a student. I might as well leave now. I can't believe that I let the mannequin die. First ask yourself, was that the intent? Was that the learning outcome? Or were we just having fun in there? We cannot have fun for our sake. Those are the things that are traumatizing these learners. And when I think about it, and I think back to my own nursing school, I'm like, I mean, I was traumatized when I was by myself on the clinical floor. Imagine being traumatized in a simulated experience, because I'm sure these healthcare learners, just like nurses, they want to do the very best they can do. They are their own worst enemy. They're extremely driven. And for them to fail at something, It's pretty traumatic. So now we're trying to clean up the damage, right? These learners are entering the healthcare setting and they're using simulation all the time. And some of them are going in saying, oh my God, I don't want to do that again. So traumatized from my early years.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. But like you said, it goes back to that intentionality. And that leads me to ask you this. Beyond preparation, what are some of the key tenets or considerations when planning a successful simulation?
So the number one tenet is planning. It's really a thoughtful simulation design. Doing that initial assessment, what do we need to do? I always recommend I look at incidents, I look at prevalence, I look at where are my students really struggling. Is there a topic that is just difficult and it's always difficult? For instance, managing a diabetic and ketoacidosis, that's some high-level concepts in there. Identifying the content. Sometimes we do trend content. I lived in Orlando for many years and we have a large transgender population. Our students needed to understand and know how to care for this unique population. So we created simulations caring for transgender populations. So when you look and you do your assessment, so you listen to other voices, you listen to other faculty member, you follow the trends, you follow your governing bodies. What are they being tested on? Then you decide, this is what we're going to do our simulation on. Then you create this storyboard, if you will, and I get SNEs. Subject matter experts. I am an adult nurse practitioner. I wouldn't know what to do with a child. So I am going to go find my experts in pediatric management or OB or gerontology or cardiology, have them write these very robust cases. Then being honest with ourselves, how many learning outcomes can my learner really achieve in a 30-minute simulation? And just trying to narrow it down and really provide that focus around my learning outcomes. Creating the simulations, making sure they are evidence-based. Good practices like every year going back into those simulations that you've tried and true and looking at them and saying, is this still consistent with practice today? Is this evidence-based? And many times we'll find, you know what, Laura, this drug is no longer being used. We have a new drug. Pulling those things into the simulation and making sure that it's evident. And we pilot things. You just don't want to throw it out there and see what happens, see how it unfolds. Then planning, and I'm a huge proponent of evaluation. I feel like if it's worth doing, it's worth evaluating. And you could evaluate learner outcomes in terms of did they master whatever competencies. You could evaluate subjectively, did they even enjoy that? And that's low-hanging fruit, obviously. But the more complex, the more evaluation that you want to put in there, the better, the more likelihood you are to share that and it's going to be adopted. That's how we always approach simulation. It's a very thought-out process, which wasn't the way it always was. It was a little Wild West, and we would just put things on paper and say, let's go with it on the fly. But we've realized to have that intentionality, as you mentioned, Sarah, it provides for that repeatable, standardized experience so that no matter who's delivering the sim, my learners are going to have the same experience. So I always suggest going to sim design. It's laid out there step by step for you. You can't go wrong.
Absolutely. And you mentioned something just now that I think that is important, especially for our audience. Our programs, like many health professions programs, struggle to find clinical sites. It's our number one rate limiting step. And so we talk about the benefits of simulation. I know that one of the things is the consistency piece or standardization piece you just talked about. Do you want to speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, we recognize that healthcare, it's at a turning point right now, and it's very difficult to get students into the healthcare setting. Our learners are there in the evening, on the weekends, overnight, just to get those clinical experiences. And then we know not every clinical day is going to be top notch. You may find yourself following your provider all day or taking care of very mundane tasks. So how do I maximize this learning? Identifying what is important for these people to know. What are the, for these early practitioners, what is important to know? Creating those simulations. I can tell you anecdotally, learners, it's very difficult to get into labor and delivery, and it's been very difficult to L&D. And I think it's across the board, right?
It is.
Our students are going to get to go, one day for 12 hours. And guess what? They may never see a birth.
Yes.
They're just standing around. I'm sure they're learning how to communicate and so forth. But we can do an amazing job. We can do a vaginal birth with our simulator. We could do a precipitous delivery. We can do a shoulder dystocia. These are things that, while we call them, you know, low incidence, but high impact, right? If they see that, they need to know what to do. So we can create these high quality simulations. We can show a vaginal birth. Think about that is so much more valuable, if you ask me, than spending 12 hours on a unit and really not having an opportunity to be involved in any of those things.
For sure. Absolutely. And that exposure, like you talked about over and over, is so important because, again, you have to be prepared for anything to walk through the door. So absolutely. So I know that your work has really focused on deliberate practice. Can you tell us why that's effective in improving learning outcomes?
Absolutely. That's a great question, Sarah. So a lot of my work has been in deliberate practice for mastery learning and understanding that one checkoff or one simulated experience is really not enough to demonstrate mastery. And unfortunately, with the time constraints in our curriculum, we are forced to approach it that way. But what we know is providing that immediate feedback, that course correction in time, is invaluable. And that's how they learn. We shouldn't be allowing them to complete an entire experience and then go back and say, you missed this, you missed this, you missed this. But really allowing them to evolve and showing them, why don't you try this? Let's do it again. Why don't you go ahead and try this now? Let's do it again. And they are auto-correcting, and you will find that the learners will improve. So that's what deliberate practice means. We talk about practicing in 10,000 hours because you're giving feedback along the way, and the learners can take that feedback, they can generate a new schema, and then they can work on the skill again. So anytime we're talking about skill acquisition, especially in simulation, providing that immediate feedback is certainly going to enhance their outcomes.
Absolutely. And that's the differentiator, to your point. 10,000 hours without having that feedback is just 10,000 hours. It could be 10,000 hours wrong. So that feedback is so important. Well, we're coming to the end of our questions at this point, but I want to open it up to you. And any parting thoughts or you know, questions I didn't ask you, things that you want me to, topics to explore?
We talked about timing, and I'd like to add a little more to timing. When I think of advanced practice and I think of PAs, I think it's useful and I think it's prudent to provide these types of simulations before they enter the clinical setting, just really helping them shore up their interview skills, really just understanding, going through a review of systems, doing those physical assessments and working out the kinks, right? Those preliminary tries before they enter the clinical setting. And I know that some programs don't use simulation for clinical replacement hours, and it's unfortunate, and we're seeing that as well in advanced practice. But providing those experiences before they enter the clinical setting is very valuable. And I also think we have to think beyond just mannequin-based. We are seeing tremendous strides in both virtual reality, mixed reality, digital screen-based simulations that are high quality, that can be delivered in an asynchronous remote format, if you will, depending on your program. Again, it's another tool in our arsenal that we can use for our learners. And then learners learn differently. We're trying to meet those auditory learners, those kinesthetic learners. But the ability to have some autonomy that I can just open up my browser and I can do the simulation, I can spend some time thinking about it in preparation. I used to get the biggest charge out of hearing from my students after they've been a week in simulation. Hey, Dr. Gonzalez, I was on the unit and it was exactly what you said. It was exactly what we did in sim. The patient had XYZ and exactly what we talked about in class. That's how it unfolded. That's a connection they've made. They've made that learning connection, that ability to carry that forth. That is why it's so valuable. And then to make mistakes in that setting. And we talked about resources. And I think it's also important to mention Katie Herling, who is a simulationist. She did a huge study where she looked at the resources for high fidelity versus a digital screen-based. So it is far more cost-effective to do digital and screen-based. So if you don't have the schools that are under-resourced and don't have the money for this huge suite of simulators, there are options. There's other modalities that can be implemented with comparable learning outcomes. So that's also something to think about.
Thank you for sharing that, especially, like you said, knowing that there is such a wide range of available resources. And like you said, just the tools, knowing that they're just as effective in many cases is really helpful. Laura, thank you so much for your time today. I certainly have learned a lot, and I know our listeners will as well.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It was really a pleasure.
And I want to thank everybody who's listening to our episode today of All Things PA Education Podcast. Join us each month as we continue our conversation with key voices in the PA education profession. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And don't forget to check out PAEA's other podcasts for PA education professionals, The PA Path, where prospective PAs, PA students, and current PAs can learn more about the profession and the paths the PAs take to serve their communities. And the JPAE Podcast, a podcast where we meet one-on-one with authors of featured articles from the Journal of PA Education.